From a very simple standpoint, the developing brain is just a profoundly selfish organ. It needs energy, it wants energy, it scavenges energy, and something needs to provide it with energy to do all the things that it does. And I think that the most principal question we have to answer, how does the microbiome, if at all, provide that energy?
Welcome to the Science, Microbes, and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization, also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. In our podcast, you'll hear about emerging topics across the fields of biotic substances and microbiome science. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Daniel Tancredi.
Hello, everybody. My name's Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And today's guest is Eldon Gisarevich. And Eldon has a fascinating backstory, both personally and in terms of his science. And we want to explore that with him today. But Eldon is an assistant professor in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, Reproductive Sciences, and Computational Systems Biology at the University of Pittsburgh. That's a long departmental name, Eldon. And you're going to share with us some of the work you do on how the maternal microbiota might contribute to offspring neurodevelopment. So it's a really fascinating area and part of our kind of focus recently on brain-gut.
Yes, Eldon, can you tell us how you came to work in this area? And you can begin with your inspiring journey as a refugee.
Great, thank you. So first, I wanted to thank you both for inviting me to come and have this chat with you. So yes, how did I get into studying the role of the maternal microbiome on offspring neurodevelopment and how these interactions early in life may increase disease susceptibility across the lifespan? And it's largely as a byproduct of my own personal experiences. So I was born in Bosnia in a small town called Bicko, which actually is in the northeastern corridor of Bosnia. So shares borders with Bosnia, Serbia, and Croatia. And this becomes important because in 92, for those that recall, the Balkan Civil War broke out, and it was really the epicenter of a lot of struggles during that time. So my family and I escaped. From there, we fled to Italy, specifically in Verona, where we were there for a little bit, and then relocated to Munich in Germany. We stayed there for about 5 years, and then through a series of events, we received a refugee-seeking asylum status in the United States, and we moved to St. Louis, Missouri, which actually ended up being a huge source of diaspora for refugee-seeking asylum, particularly Bosnian Muslims. And from there, then, I went on to the University of Missouri in Columbia, Missouri. I first actually started out as a creative writing major, focused on poetry, because I really had, I think, a lot to share, and I wanted to do it through poetry. And then I switched quite a bit. First was to religious studies, because I became really interested in the religious aftermath of what's happening in Eastern Europe. And then my parents very kindly reminded me of what kind of career I could have with a bachelor's of arts in religious studies. And then so I swiftly became a pre-med, but really a dual major in anthropology and psychology. And so in undergrad, I took a course that was titled Pediatric Neuropsychopathology, and this was with Debbie Bell, still doing work to this day. And one day in the class, she pulled me aside and said, "Are you from Bosnia? Because your name is Bosnia." And I said, "Yes." And I don't really get this a lot, particularly in a place like Columbia, Missouri, you may imagine. And she said, "Well, I just came back from a sabbatical doing assessments of the children that stayed in Bosnia during the war." And this was one of those really, truly formative experiences for me, where it made me realize that, one, my own experiences, right? So the experiences of being a refugee, of a first-generation student, and also a sort of a product of displacement may have an impact on either the resilience or the risk for my own some mental health struggles, because we know, right, early life trauma has a huge impact on lifelong health. But it also made me realize that there's a real professional drive to answer some of these questions. And that's really what got me into this field, sort of into trying to understand how environmental factors, whether they be diet or stress, have an impact not only on mom, but what does that mean then for the next generation? And of course, right, as everyone listening to this podcast is familiar, you know, this research has been done for more than a century, and there has been lots of theorizing on, you know, what signals are deriving from what to tell the offspring that there's something imminently different about the environment and how to either adapt or not to the environment. And I think what brought us here is really that the microbiome might be one of those key players, right? So that's sort of the new idea. First, it was, well, there's these epigenetic changes, right? And so we have the epigenetic changes in our genome, and then there are different things. So now it's the microbiome, and we're going now into extracellular vesicles. But the key thing that we're interested in my lab is ultimately, how does something like a stressful experience or a diet signal something to the developing offspring or to developing brain to facilitate a lasting change?
Eldon, I'm really curious about this idea of imprinting of a prior experience on the offspring of the mother. And I was wondering, do you think this imprinting would be due to events that happen even pre-pregnancy or during pregnancy or postpartum? And second question, can you consider any kind of evolutionary role for why we've evolved to try to imprint upon our children memories of past experiences?
So first question is actually quite, it's both a very simple and a challenging question. One, we have really many, many decades of work where we have looked at preconception or pre-pregnancy effects and how that may impact the long-lasting consequences on offspring health, similarly pregnancy and postpartum. And the evidence is really clear. No matter when you intervene, no matter when you either in a mouse model or when we look at human populations, well, depending on when the stressor occurs, there's still some risk that is being carried. So whether the preconception stress is during puberty, those will be imprinted. And so the key question, the challenging question is, how are these things imprinted, right? How are these imprints maintaining across many, many decades in humans that could then facilitate this change? Similarly, how do they interact? So how is it that when, let's say, a woman goes through life and she's facing different stressors and different pressures, how do those become additive or synergistic to accumulate in risk, right? So what's the threshold that a system needs to say, okay, this is necessary to remember in some way, shape, or form, to imprint that memory that will be necessary to transfer to the next generation? And now going back, how could these be transferred? One of the reasons why we got into the microbiome, and particularly in terms of thinking about the quite literal transmission of microbes from one generation to the next, is actually that both conceptually and methodologically, it makes sense, right? Because you're quite literally taking a community of microbes and you're transferring it to the next generation. So if those have been changed in a stable or durable manner, that would be really represent a method of transmission of health and disease. And so, of course, the difficulty then is, once that's transferred, what are the mechanisms that could be linking this microbial community to transfer from one generation to the next to leave a lasting impact on the brain? And that's quite challenging. It's really hard to tease apart all of these different moving aspects in biology, right? Because all of these are just sort of continuing additive effects. And I think that the challenge for the field is to figure out how to develop techniques that allow us to isolate those effects. The second question is, what is the evolutionary adaptiveness? Well, we know that if you were to be born tabula rasa, so if you were born with a clean slate, which we know doesn't exist, there's a much higher risk to not understand the adaptive value of your environment and if it's constrained, right? So if there's a nutritionally constrained environment, you should be smaller and you should grow faster because your capacity to increase what's called your reproductive success or your reproductive fitness, you would have a much higher fitness if you grow smaller and faster, let's say because your environment is constrained, and be able to reproduce at higher rates than if you maintain, so the tabula rasa on a blank slate, a slow growth period, that you attain body size that your current local environment cannot support. And then you have a huge hit in reproductive success. Where this disconnect comes from, and evolutionary theories have talked about this quite a bit, is in that we're maintaining the signal. So mom is sending signals about the environment is stressful. But then you're born actually in a resource plenty environment. So this is where the current ideas and hypotheses are. It's this maladaptation where you're being signaled that there's something stressful and dangerous about the environment, and the fetal programming has occurred as such. And then you're delivered into an environment that doesn't actually match those expectations.
And then that results in obesity and so on, right?
That's the current hypothesis. Absolutely. So you're programmed for a particular environment and it doesn't match it. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about specific mechanisms. So, for example, I know you've done work, Eldon, on how stress on the mom can lead to alterations in the vaginal microbiome in terms of like the lactobacilli, and that ends up affecting the infant. I mean, how immediately would that stress need to be applied in order to lead to the alteration? Like, let's imagine that in your mouse model, the mom had no stress until rather late before delivery. Like, how much time is needed before you see the alteration?
So we are certainly not the first ones that were doing this work, right? So if we think about Mike Bailey's work from the, you know, early 90s that has done this work in non-human primates, right? So disassociating the acute and chronic effects. One bout of an acute stressor can impact the microbial community, right? So all the beautiful work that's been done from John Krein's lab, right? That this notion that even an acute stressor increases the volatility or sort of the random nature of a microbiome. So it could actually be quite acute. In our setting, we were really interested in the first week of pregnancy. So all of our, in the early prenatal stress model, our female mice, once we confirmed pregnancy, they're all stressed with non-habituating, but also fairly mild stressors. So they're not put into a squeeze chute for 2 hours. So what we have is non-habituating mild stressors. And what we see is pretty much actually after the first stressor, the microbiome senses a change. And people have already shown how that happens, right? Through changes in catecholamine signaling and changes in corticosterone or cortisol signaling. And so that fundamentally changes the community. And then as you expose the mice to various different stressors, that chain just continues. When you release them of the stress, here's where the difficulty comes in with pregnancy, right? Is because pregnancy on its own is going to have an effect on the signature of the microbiome, particularly the gut microbiome, but also the vaginal microbiome. So now you have these two different systems. So what we found is that stress exposure early in pregnancy almost induces this kind of catabolic signature in the microbiome in terms of its own function, and then it stays that way. So it ends up being actually a very lasting effect, and it synergizes with what is actually going on in pregnancy. So it becomes actually a very different effect when we're looking at how does stress affect the microbiome in pregnancy than, let's say, in a non-pregnant state or in males. So to your question of if we could... So based on the principles of what we know about acute stress exposure, if we were to expose an animal for the last couple of days prior to parturition to stress, could we affect the microbial community? Absolutely. Would that be transferred to the next generation? Yes. We know this also in studies that use antibiotic exposure. The typical regimen is to expose and disrupt the microbiome about 2 or 3 days prior to parturition. And you can see that those communities are transferred. The key with our work, particularly in the early prenatal stress model that we have to resolve, is that we also know that stress on its own, independent of the microbiome, is going to have a fetal programmatic effect. So some of the work that we had to do in these models is to really try to tease apart how the well-known stress effect on the placenta and on the brain, because how can we actually mechanistically say that any of these changes to the microbiome are either conspirators or drivers of these changes. And so this is where we started doing some of the work where we were manipulating the colonizing microbiota of animals that had either exposure to stress in utero or not. It's to really get at this question of, well, it could be that just, the microbiome in the presence of stress is also changing. That's not really fundamentally doing much of anything else, right? It's really the effect of stress. So again, going back to technique development, right? This is where that challenge comes from. But this is the challenge for anyone interested in generational transmission of disease. So,
and Eldon, I was curious. I mean, I'm very conscious that we're three men discussing pregnancy and transmission, where, you know, we don't actually get to participate in any of that. And I would hate for, you know, women to listening to this to think, oh, this is yet another thing I'm responsible for, is, you know, passing on a microbiome that's going to lead potentially to chronic disease in my children. But where's the practical implications of this? I mean, I would hate again to think of a woman saying, I'm going to avoid antibiotics throughout my pregnancy, even if I need them, because I'm going to protect my unborn child, or you know what I'm getting at. You know, are there any practical things that if we do believe that the microbiome is a component at least of this transfer. What can you do to prevent any kind of ill effects due to interfering with the microbiome?
I've been actually thinking about this a lot, and I think that one critical need that we really need to, that we have in the microbiome field, particularly in this area, how does the maternal microbiome in pregnancy change and what happens in the presence of stress or in antibiotics or in diet are actually the human studies that do use interventions, right? So we know in a non-pregnancy state, so meditation-based stress reduction is really good and it works really well. Well, does the interaction between early life trauma and things like meditation-based stress reduction have an impact on the microbiome? How does this impact in pregnancy? What is the role of prebiotics, probiotics, symbiotics, psychobiotics in this process? I think that what has ended up happening is that we're not actually having those follow-up practical studies to actually ask those questions. And I think for us, it's a really critical need. We're doing a lot of studies in the context of gestational diabetes, for instance. So here at McGee Women's Hospital, we have about 1,000 women that become gestational diabetic. We know the risks. The key difference in the clinical care management that happens here is that many of the women are given nutritional advice. But when we say nutritional advice, it's really focused on eat less carbs. That's kind of it. And then see you in 2 weeks to see if you've regained control over your glucose levels. But what ends up happening, even with that very scant advice, about 50% of these patients end up regaining control over their glucose levels. The other 50 are then, so it's a sort of flip of a coin, right? The other 50 end up being given insulin, and so it's kind of terrible, but it's slowly, you know, there's low compliance rates and so on and so forth. But even in this context, right, understanding how diet interacts with the microbiome and how we can reverse engineer knowledge, the sort of very vast knowledge that we have about diet affecting glucose levels and glycemic control, and then being able to give women so the agency and autonomy to make those decisions of what kind of diets they should be consuming may either increase their probability or at least give them the information that they need. And this is sort of what we really struggle with within women's health, and particularly maternal child health, is this idea of how do we actually get the necessary information? How do we actually do the science that we can then give the patients their own agency and autonomy rather than just saying, well, we think this works. We don't know why medical nutritional therapies work, but we can recommend this to you. So it's a, I think that you raise a really great question because it's a really a call for more information, more data in this area.
Well, speaking of more data and the state of the science, Eldon, can you give us your thoughts on the state of the science with regard to how the maternal microbiome influences neural development and the offspring?
Yeah, I think that from a very simple standpoint, the developing brain is just a profoundly selfish organ. It needs energy. It wants energy. It scavenges energy. And something needs to provide it with energy to do all the things that it does. And I think that the most principal question we have to answer, how does the microbiome, if at all, provide that energy? We know this in studies in germ-free mice, right? There are, of course, differences in total brain structures. There's some beautiful work from Elaine Schell and colleagues that have shown that in the absence of a total microbiome, there are all kinds of different changes in neural circuits, that there are differences in epigenetic signaling in the brain, that metabolites could or could not be. I mean, so studies have to be done. They can be transferred from the microbiome directly across the placenta and into the brain to facilitate this. So I think that disrupting the microbiome at these key stages is principally affecting nutrient availability for the developing brain. What does that also mean then for development of circuits during that time? Well, the circuits have to be epigenetically controlled, right? We know that metabolites, we're starting to recognize and appreciate, the metabolites, in addition to providing energy and, you know, scaffolding, they're also involved in the timing of key epigenetic processes that have to occur. And if you miss them, then disorder happens.
Yes. What about the you know, the whole concept of missing microbes, that in modern society with our, you know, the hygiene hypothesis and so on, that we're losing contact with ancient members of our microbiomes that may have had very significant roles in this kind of signaling? Do you think there's any evidence to support that?
I think that the notion of missing microbes has been shown a great deal in the mouse literature. right? So even if we just compare C57 black mice, for instance, that come from different vendors. So animals that come from JAXA laboratories because of hygiene practices, for instance, they miss segmental filamentous bacteria, which is a crucially important inducer of IL-17 producing T cells. Conversely, black 6 mice from Taconic, they're enriched, they have SFB, and we know that the presence or absence of the single microbe has a huge impact on maternal immunity, on immunity at the maternal fetal interface, but also neuroimmune development during the fetal window. So then the question becomes, of course, what other missing microbes are there, at least just in a murine setting, that we can learn about, you know, and when are they important? So for instance, immunity across pregnancy changes quite a bit. Are those microbes responding, educating, tolerizing during this window or engaging in increased protection from disease? And what happens when we miss that balance? And I think that starting first with the fundamental work of identifying which microbes are necessary, what stage of pregnancy or what stage of fetal development will allow us then to make the sort of the translation relevant leap of saying what happens in humans when we start missing these bugs or these microbes, and what methods can we use to boost them, or, you know, things like FMTs, right? Because even with FMTs, we still have to make sure that the diet supports the community that is being transferred. So I think that starting, I think the key here is really also just getting more and more people into this area is to ask about specific microbes and their functions, and how do then those relate to immune development and then allowing us the translational leap. But I think we will be able to make that leap very easily.
And there has been some controversy, I guess, about the notion of, you know, vaginal swabs and then swabbing the newborn baby to deliberately treat,
yes,
particularly in cesarean births, let's say. What do you think the evidence is like there?
Yeah, so we started when we had our paper that was published in Nature Neuroscience in 2018. We used a C-section model to be able to stop the vertical transmission of microbiota and then to be able to colonize animals with either defined or undefined communities to really ask, to what extent does the prenatal programming of being, of experiencing stress or a high-fat diet, obesogenic environment program your response to the colonizing microbiome? And so what ended up happening in a consequence of that paper being published is that we started getting asked these questions about, what about C-section, vaginal seeding, VMTs, FMTs for newborns? And I think that for me right now, the answer would be, because we're not currently understanding what has happened to mom during the pre-pregnancy period, preconception period, and what pregnancy looked like, the basic science data suggesting that, let's say, a woman that is obese or an animal that's consuming an obesogenic environment, those pups that are born are going to have a fundamental different response to the same microbial community than an animal that has not. So one of the key questions that we have not really anticipated in this dialogue is, how are you born? What did your prenatal environment look like? And then how will you respond to even a prebiotic community? You may, you know, one baby may not really respond really well to bifidobacteria. Another one, it could save their life. And so understanding that individual heterogeneity will become really important in trying to understand where VMTs and FMTs early in life will be beneficial, where they could actually be dangerous. I think that, you know, there is a lot of data suggesting things like HSV, because it can asymptomatically shed into the reproductive canal. There have been cases of babies who have received VMTs who have developed HSV lesions on their faces. So there is also a precautionary principle that has to be applied in asking ourselves, can we screen these microbial communities well before actually the colonization occurs? And then trying to understand a little bit about mom's health during pregnancy and how does that actually associate to an immunological response when we do colonize babies.
Can you tell us where you see your future steps? Like what has you excited about, like, let's say the next 5 years, where your research is going and where your colleagues are going?
So for me, where we are going is actually sort of, we're starting at the beginning. So we recently had a preprint where we found a very surprising phenomenon. It's actually something that's been known with animals that are germ-free for a long, long time, which is they're really sort of poor reproducers. They're sort of really poor breeders. And it turns out that this has been just something that's been known in facilities that breed germ-free mice for a long time.
That's just because scientists are around. You know, it's kind of hard.
Yes, that's exactly it. There's a bunch of nerds just sitting around watching them. Yes, the audience effect. So then we collected some data from Taconic, who had breeding data. And what we found was that even though the germ-free mice have normal-sized litters for the first couple of litters, they start to become and experience something called secondary infertility. So they just become sterile after the fourth litter. A typical lifespan of a mouse, at least in laboratory settings, is about 10 to 11 litters. So even though germ-free mice live just as long, actually, if not longer, than mice that are colonized, they just start reproducing after the fourth litter. And this sort of fits with what people have known. And so a lot of the work that we have done is to identify actually, so the reason why these animals become sterile after the fourth litter is because the ovarian reserve, so the number of primordial follicles, which reflect the total reproductive potential in a mammal, is by the time these animals reach adulthood, these animals being germ-free mice, is reduced by 50%. So their reproductive potential and their reproductive capacity is reduced by 50% in a germ-free setting. So then we went back and we asked, well, is it just because they're just starting with less eggs and less germ cells? Turns out not. It turns out that when they're born, they have the same ovarian reserve during the first week of life. But what happens is across postnatal development is that there is an exponential loss of these eggs, such that by the time that you reach sexual maturity and active reproduction, your reproductive capacity is reduced by 50%. So, and then we did a bunch of work, and this is in the preprint, where we colonize animals at different times in postnatal development. And what our data suggests is that at the time of the weaning transition, so when mice start to transition from a breast milk-associated microbiome to a more adult-like state, if you colonize the animals at that time, but not after, you can rescue the ovarian reserve. Colonizing them earlier at birth doesn't really matter.
You mean you could rescue, you could avoid the depletion of the ovarian?
Correct.
Well,
Correct. And then, so then we worked on what are the systems, what is happening? So I think that where do we really see the field going? I think that what we're going to see is a huge explosion in trying to understand host microbe interactions in women's health, in preconception health, in fertility. I think that that will be a real key area that will expand, because of course, if you can improve and you can produce higher quality eggs, what does that look like, right? So if you start the interventions much earlier, if we consider the microbiome and microbiome-directed interventions at much earlier time points, you know, even before pregnancy, what does that look like? I think that that's, for us, an area that we're really excited about. Another key area that I'm very excited about is this idea of transfer metabolites from the maternal gut compartment to the placenta and to things like the brain. So there are methods now that are available, including stable isotope tracing methods, where we can feed animals carbon-13 labeled dietary substrate, so fiber, different things, and then ask where, if we can track the dispersal of these microbial-derived metabolites, where are they going? What are they doing? What biology are they contributing to? At what time point? So I think that this will really revolutionize this knowledge of, you know, how are these things really directly impacting brain development? Because so far, and I think within reason, so far we've just done a lot of the studies with the notion of, well, in the presence or absence of a microbiome, or in the presence or absence of defined communities, what happens? Now this will allow us to ask, in the presence of complex communities that are doing different things in the, over the course of pregnancy, to facilitate placental development, brain development, circuit formation, what are they doing and when do they become necessary? I think that this will really unlock the way that we think about even potentially interventions in the setting. Because once we know actually what are they doing and how are they responding to something as dynamically as metabolic and neurological needs in pregnancy.
Well, that's a really inspiring vision, I think, for us. At the end of a very inspiring journey that you've been on, both personally and scientifically. So, Eldon, thank you so much for giving us your time and talking about such a fascinating topic. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. Check the show notes for links and further information on this topic. You can also send us your feedback, questions or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org. And don't forget to follow or subscribe to this podcast so you never miss a new episode.